Welcome to the We Must Act Now podcast, the podcast about climate change and other important issues. This is our second season, and the second season is the Climate Change Chronicles, where we chronicle climate change from the beginning to, hopefully, its end. Thank you for listening. We'll be back after this. Hello. Welcome back. Today we're going to be talking about the beginning of climate change. Well, maybe not the beginning, but when it started spiking. The Industrial Revolution. And we will release one of my favorite segments, the segment of me and Bruce Ozzie's interview. Yeah, I just can't wait. Here's our episode.
The beginning of the Industrial Revolution began in Great Britain, and they have profited from an agrarian revolution with new crops and farming practices. And fortunately for the crown, the enclosure movement, let me give you a little context. So, in England, there used to be pretty public spaces, and that were used for playing, farming, stuff like that. But the enclosure movement made them private, sold them off, and made them into big farms, which fortunately had a lot bigger crop boost, but a lot less, the peasants were forced to move into the cities, and it was good and bad. And another reason is because Britain is just, it has a massive empire, and it had many natural resources, like iron and coal. And it also had many rivers that helped with the mills. And, And just the significance of the revolution, it allowed more goods to be produced, more things, faster. It was done in factories where, had many jobs, although little pay and long hours, which was a minus. It depends on how you see it. Because, on one level, it's a massive boost for civilization. On the second level, on a different level, it's hard. It depends on what you think. And it also hit Belgium, France, and Germany. And they really encouraged it because they built new railroads and canals, and the Japanese industrialized too. Now that was a really interesting thing that came about with the Restoration, the Great Restoration. Yeah, and new technology like steam power, steam boats, steam locomotives, steam engines, a regular locomotive, the telegraph, it used Morse code, which I kind of don't get, not that I don't get that, I don't get, how they put all the stuff the wire into place without it taking trillions of years and trillions of dollars. But, I guess. There was also, there were a bunch of factories the American Industrial Revolution started in Rhode Island in 1993 when a certain Samuel Slater built the first American spinning mill. A factory that would make cloth. And Rhode Island's geography was perfect for running water-powered mills. Although the War of 1812 made it tough to get imported goods, Americans could find more efficient ways. They inspired. They could do it on their own. The most famous one was probably the one started by Francis Cabot Lowell in 1814, and it mostly employed young women. It was an incredible success. It founded an entire town called Lowell, Massachusetts. The Lowell girls were paid well, but they worked long hours in grueling conditions, unfortunately. Now, a lot of other stuff was made, like the spinning jenny, the cotton gin, the John Deere plow, and the McCormick Reaper. I don't understand the names of those, like, whatever. But, to be honest, I think it was good. All in all, the Industrial Revolution was a good thing. You know? Yeah. Huh. But, I guess, on the point of bad, if the Industrial Revolution was bad, you could look at child labor. And although it was a time of incredible, like, and a feat of incredible engineering and incredible mechanical technology, but at what cost? Children were paid much less than adults, and by 1810, about 2 million children worked at least six 10-hour days a week for as little as 40 cents a day. Wow. That's kind of crazy. That's $2.40 a week. And even by today's standards of money, that's so little. And they were from poor immigrant families that relied on their children's wages to eat, which helped and didn't help. But church group and teachers worked hard to change child labor laws. Also, they didn't have time to go to school, which, really bad part. Yeah. But church groups and teachers worked hard to change the child labor laws. By 1878, Great Britain and most of Europe had passed laws that improved working conditions and shortened work days, as well as raised age requirements. The U.S. Congress wouldn't pass the Fair Labor Standards Act until 1938, and today millions of children around the world still work long hours under dangerous conditions with little access to education. That's sad. But fortunately for me, and fortunately for my long rambling history lesson, there was a second Industrial Revolution starting in the late 1800s. Well, it started when the British made steel production less difficult and less expensive, making railroad conduction easier and skyscrapers possible with the Bessemer steel process. The Bessemer steel process involved using oxygen and air blown through molten pig iron to burn off the impurities and thus create steel. I don't understand that at all. Not one bit. Not one bit. But now, inventions galore is the correct thing for this. The first transatlantic telegraph wire was put into place, which, how was that possible? The technology at the time, how was that possible? I should look that up. And the first commercial typewriter was invented by Christopher Sholes, Charles Glidden, and Samuel W. Soule. If I get anything wrong in words, I know I'm bad at pronunciation. And Thomas Edison opened a lab in New Jersey and went to patent more than 1,000 inventions. In 1879, he invented the first electric light bulb. Think about that. That's kind of crazy. But, yeah. And the most famous, and probably for everybody here, the most, well, maybe not, it depends, really important invention, the first airplane flight, successful. I think there were a few non-successful flights, yeah. And Henry Ford devised the Model T car, created by his innovative assembly line system. So, yeah. Although this is not just about history, although I do really have a passion for history, fortunately, it's also about climate change. And there's a few graphs that could help demonstrate my point. I can't really describe a graph to you, but by the 1900s, more than 1,000 million metric tons of carbon were being burned, and just a little pre-thing, because we're doing Climate Change Chronicles, it's grown massively, just massively, more than like tenfold from 1900. Crazy. Well, I know a personal friend of mine has really been begging for the Bruce Ozzie interview. I wonder if it for you guys too. I thought it was a really interesting interview. Now, for people who listened, I'm gonna release it with this episode. For people who listened to the trailer, go to I think about 3:30 and. Well, I really hope you enjoy, because, it was such a fun interview. I need to do more interviews. Yeah, I will. Thanks. Enjoy listening. Hi, welcome back to We Must Act Now, the climate podcast that details history of climate change, what you can do, and all the things in between. Today, we're having a very special interview with Bruce Ozzie. He is also my grandpa, which you may find interesting. Say hello.
Well, thank you, Harry. I'm looking forward to this episode in your podcast series.
Thank you. Do you want to tell listeners anything about your past? Anything?
Well, I have always loved the outdoors, and I was fortunate to have a career in environmental education, working with young boys and girls and exposing them to the great outdoors. And we did this in a number of different activities, everything from kayaking to backpacking to fishing and hunting and a variety of different adventures. So.
Interesting. Now, could you tell listeners, what was your favorite part about the job?
Oh, just exposing young people and kind of watching their eyes light up when they tried something new, particularly as it related to an outdoor adventure. In many cases, they had never experienced these things, and so it was very easy to work with them and teach them.
Interesting. Very interesting. Now, I wish I could talk to you forever, which luckily I can, but let's start the interview. So, did you ever see any litter in your childhood?
Oh, we would see litter, but it was quite a bit different than the litter that you see today. For one thing, there was very little plastic, so you didn't have the disposable water bottles and soda containers and plastic cups that you get at the fast food joints. You didn't have plastic bags at the grocery store. Everything was paper. So there wasn't near the material, that was generated. So We would see litter in the way of glass bottles, because all the soda containers were pretty much in glass. And, you know, not as many people in the area where I grew up. It was a rural area, so we didn't have near the litter problems that you see today.
Now, when did you notice a spike in these single-use things?
Oh, I think plastic is a big driver of litter. It's just so easy to throw out the window or drop where you happen to be or sat down. So I think really you started seeing a spike when plastic became more available.
Now, when did you notice that the environment was changing?
As far as temperature, you mean?
Well, temperature or habitat or species?
Well, I think the most noticeable thing that I've noticed as far as a change is in our climate. When I was growing up, we had winter from and this is in southern Minnesota, south of Rochester, Harmony. We had winter would probably arrive around the 1st of November, and sometimes it wouldn't get over with until maybe even the middle of April when we'd have our last snowstorm. And now winter seems to be much, much shorter, not nearly as severe, not as much snow. So I think the winter is the biggest change that I've noticed. And from what I've read, I think our Minnesota winters are more a change than even the summer. So the biggest change has been just a change in climate. And along with that, obviously, our flora and fauna reacts to those changes, and there is difference for sure.
Now, what extreme climate events have you noticed have gotten worse?
Well, obviously, one of them right now we're enduring with our drought, the current drought that we've had, and the forest fires, particularly in Ontario and Manitoba, that's creating unhealthy air quality for us. And this has gone on for several days now. So this is an extreme event. And then you have the 1,000-year floods or the 500-year floods that are happening now quite frequently, in which you would get anywhere from 7 to 10 to 15 inches of rain in a period of 24 or 36 hours. So we're getting extremes in the weather, whether it be heat or moisture extremes, and this is quite obvious.
Now, when did you hear about the greenhouse effect or climate change, and what did you think about it?
Well, I think the thing that really got people's attention was when former Vice President Al Gore came out with his book, The Inconvenient Truth. And he was the first one that really pulled the fire alarm in regard to climate change and global warming. And there's been many voices that have added to that story since he came out with the book. But that was really the first that people started talking about how things are changing because of the amount of carbon dioxide that we're putting into the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think people should do about this? Or what do you think they can do to help?
Well, I think probably there are many things, but I think one thing is to probably live a little bit more simply. There's a quote that says, live simply so others might simply live.
That's a beautiful quote.
And the more things that we have and the more we travel and the more that we do, this adds carbon dioxide to the environment. So I guess it's probably the simplest thing is to try to reduce and enjoy what we have rather than to constantly get more and more.
That is such a beautiful response. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you for including me in your podcast.
Oh, you're welcome. It's the least I could do.
All right. Thank you.